Cheryl, are you here? Can you unmute yourself?
I am here.
So here's how God works. Our speaker was supposed to be Gloria V, and I got this spontaneous call when Rod was talking. Gloria can't make it. I'm like, well, we've got to make some improvisations here. Now, the original plan, when I got this idea, I called Juanita and I called some people that were involved with Native American Conference. I said, help. I said, I need help. So they helped me with this. And one of the things that Juanita did was contact Cheryl. Now, I didn't know that. I mean, I know she was contacting people. And apparently Cheryl had a death in the family and did not connect with Juanita, couldn't make it, couldn't do it. Something to the effects of that. And if I'm not correctly relating this back to you, Cheryl, by all means. So I didn't know this. So I'm calling Dawn. I said to Dawn, I call Juanita. Juanita says, call Dawn. And I said, Dawn, get me so-and-so. And he comes back and he said, well, I've got so-and-so. I'm like, I'll take whatever you've got. I mean, I'm good. So I get Cheryl's name. I call Cheryl. Then I call Juanita and I said, oh, I said, guess what? I said, it's not this, but it's this. I said, I really, God has taken control here. And she goes, oh, that's interesting. She goes, because I have been trying so hard to get Cheryl to speak this weekend. She goes, it's not even funny. And I paraphrase because she doesn't talk like that. So I said, now, isn't that interesting? We've got Cheryl closing the conference. Cheryl was supposed to be here, whether Cheryl knew about it or not. So Cheryl, we're excited that you're here. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here. It was true that when Juanita was trying to reach me, it was a bad time. We were in the middle of a funeral for my niece. She unfortunately overdosed, and it was a really, as you all know, painful time. And so it just flew out of my head to get back together with Juanita. And normally my weekends are booked at least a month ahead of time with family. I have a huge family. And for whatever reason, this afternoon, I had nothing going on. And I thought to myself, this is really strange to not have something. And then Don reached out to me and said, we need a speaker. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. This conference was happening. So I guess things work out the way that they're supposed to. So I am going to do a little bit of a traditional introduction in my language, and then I'll tell you what I said. Buju mikwa minsikwe indigo ginyu indudem odawa zagai gunning indonjiba gigun shagamud endad. In my traditional Ojibwe culture, it's respectful to always introduce yourself in this traditional way. And so I'm introducing myself with my spirit name, which means Little Ice Woman. And I'm from the Eagle Clan. I come from the village of the traders is how you would literally translate it. But it's called for the government's purposes, it's called Lacouture Reservation, which is French, so which is a whole different story. So, but and my reservation is in Northwest Wisconsin, in the Midwest, up by the Great Lakes. Our tribe is in the states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, and all over in Canada. It's a big tribe, and I sit here today having, I would say that the 12 steps in general have been, saved my life. I've been a member of Al-Anon since 1977 and a very grateful member, and a very grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous since July 15th, 1979. And I do not doubt for a moment that if it was not for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be alive. I would not be here. So anytime I have a chance to talk or share, I feel really blessed to do that, to share forward the message of what this amazing program did for me and can do for so many others. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to hear most of the other speakers. I would have loved to have done that. I hope it does get recorded. There is a man who came from my home reservation named Eugene B., and some people might recognize his name, and he might have been mentioned earlier this weekend. I'm not sure, but I take great pride in the fact that he came from my home reservation and that he shared with people that I know. I was not blessed to hear him speak this before he passed away, but he had shared that he had gone to attend a Founders Day event in Akron, Ohio, when Bill W. was still alive. Dr. Bob had passed on and Bill W. was still alive. And he just felt so grateful and so honored to be able to go there. And at a certain point, Bill W. had approached him and said, could you wait until after they were going to have a memorial service at the cemetery for Dr. Bob. He said, could you wait until after that so that I could speak with you? And he felt so honored. And he was, of course, of course. And so afterwards, Bill W. had said to him, you're a Native American, aren't you? And he said, yes, I am. And he made kind of a joke about it because of the, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of the thing that most people at the time especially would think about Native Americans is that we were drunks. And he said, but I'm sober. And what Bill W. said to him was very moving because he said, you know, Dr. Bob and I were working really hard at putting the steps together and we were really struggling with it until we went and spent time with some Native American people and learned about Native American spirituality. And we took that and we brought it back and we put that into what we were trying to do with the steps. And that was the thing that we were looking for, the missing piece. And so he said, not a lot of people know this, and so I'm sharing it with you so that you can tell other people that Native American people had a really important role that you played in helping us. And so I too, like a lot of the other Native speakers that I heard, at least a little bit before me, saying, you'll hear from Native people saying, well, it's AA is a white man's program. And then I, as a counselor now for many years in treatment centers, have said, I beg to differ with you there because it's not exactly just a white man's program because Native people had a really, I think, beautiful addition to help them around spirituality. And it's a fit for me. So that I say this as I start because my recovery, the story of my recovery starts with spirituality. And I have never thought that I didn't fit in AA. I, like most of the Native American people that I know, come from a history of very severe trauma in our families for many generations. I worked at one point in my life in the area of sexual violence, and the regular program had an office right next to mine that was Native American specific, and people would come in there the first time that they had ever been sexually assaulted or the first time maybe their child had been molested. And the women that I worked with had so many layers of that experience in childhood and adulthood. And our mothers did, and our grandmothers did, and the men in our communities as well, along with poverty, brutality, racism, oppression, all of those kinds of things that they took away the healthy way that we knew how to deal with pain and hardship by outlawing our religion and our culture until 1978. And then stole our children for almost 100 years and traumatized them without giving them anything to use to deal with it in a healthy way, except to don't talk, don't tell, don't feel. And so when you stuff everything and you feel like you can't talk about it and you can't let yourself have a feeling, you set yourself up for, I feel like, the perfect storm for addiction, for alcoholism. So when I was born into my family, both my parents were alcoholic, and that had been the case for at least three generations before me. And my first memories are of my parents being drunk and fighting, and the trauma that started with that made me really not trust the world, that anything good would come to me. And so I was the oldest child in my family, and I became convinced that it was my job to protect everyone from mainly my father, who was a violent alcoholic. And so my first time being physically abused, I think I was about 2, and the first time that I was molested by my father, I was 3. And what I had found out as I grew up was that it hurt more for me to watch those kinds of things happen to my mom or my siblings than if it happened to myself. And so I tried to protect them. And if it meant taking a beating or being assaulted, I would rather have it happen to me. And so by the time I was 11, my life was, it was a very scary place. I will say that I feel like what kept me alive until I did find help later, initially, was that when I was a little girl, I would go out in the woods when it was really bad at home, and I would lay on the ground, on the earth, and I would wish to stop breathing, to not be alive. And when I started to do that, there were people that came around me, and I didn't know who they were. I was a little, before preschool, I was a little girl when it started, and they looked like older people to me. So in my mind, I called them the grandmas and the grandpas, and they would whisper things in my ear, things that I wasn't hearing at home, like, don't give up, we love you. There's important things that you're supposed to do someday. So you can't give up. You have to get back up and go back. But you're never alone. We're with you. And one of the ladies had really long hair, really long black hair past her knees. And she was the one who came the most. And I don't know why I didn't tell the adults. I guess I knew that children didn't talk too much in our family. You were supposed to be seen and not heard. So we didn't get any of the positive things of our culture. None of that got handed down to us. Like I said, it was even outlawed until 1978. So when I was 11 years old, my life at the time, I don't remember happiness. I don't remember feeling like a little kid. I felt like an adult, old adult. And when I drank enough, the adults thought it was funny to give alcohol to booze to little kids. So I'm surprised it didn't happen before 11, but that was when I drank enough that I got really drunk. And for the first time since I could remember, I did not feel fear, terror, pain, depression, self-loathing. All of that went away. Hatred, anger, any of that stuff, it was gone. And I felt like I went to the happy place, and that I never wanted to come back. And so that first time, I drank until I blacked out, I passed out, I got sick, and I didn't care about that at all. When I woke up the next day, all I wanted was to go back to the happy place. It was really easy in my household because with both of my parents being alcoholic, there was alcohol everywhere. And they were in blackouts a lot of the time, so they didn't know where it went. And so I, just to make it through a day, just to be able to be strong enough to handle everything, I drank. And I remember when young people started drinking that were my age, and I felt like I was so far beyond them. Here was the problem with my drinking, was that the more that I drank, and I never stopped unless something else stopped me. I ran out, or I blacked out or passed out. And when that happened, I was in a community where there was a lot of predators. So the more that I made myself vulnerable, the more that I was assaulted. And the more that it happened to me, the more I didn't want to live. And in my teens, I started attempting suicide, and it wasn't to get attention. I just didn't want to be here. I should say that from the time I started drinking when I was 11, I didn't see the grandmas and the grandpas anymore. And I felt sad about that because things got so much worse after I started drinking, but I couldn't stop. And I didn't realize that as a young person, that the cells in my body needed to double and quadruple and, you know, to grow to be the mature organs in your body. They were still growing, and that the one thing that could kill them was alcohol. Now there's one more that does that. That's meth, but alcohol, you know, what you could do a lot of other drugs, but alcohol would kill living cells in your body. And I didn't realize what it was doing to me. When I was about, I think, 16 years old, I had become very, very ill. I was vomiting blood and peeing blood and passing blood, and no one could figure out what was wrong with me. I got really thin because I couldn't eat. And that was the first, the doctors couldn't tell what was wrong with me, so they sent me to the Mayo Clinic. And a doctor there said, he shut the door, you know, for the first time somebody point blank asked me, "Do you drink alcohol?" And I said, "You know, well, yeah, I do." And he said, "How much and how often?" And I told him, and he got really angry. And he said, "You've destroyed your whole digestive system. You are going to bleed to death unless you stop drinking. Internally, you're going to bleed to death." And so he thought, as he's sending me home, that's, you know, I'm going to go home and not drink anymore. But I had the opposite in my mind, was, if the other ways I was trying to kill myself weren't working, maybe this, it might be a little longer, a little slower, but maybe this was the best way. So I went home and resumed drinking really heavily, actually. And I lived longer. I didn't die right away, but I wasn't well. And I experienced a lot more trauma. And a few years down the road, I was stumbling down the sidewalk on a Sunday morning, hungover. I had been at a party the night before and been sexually assaulted again. And I was trying to plan. I couldn't wait anymore to die from bleeding. I wanted to, I was trying to plan the perfect suicide that could, where I couldn't be stopped. And I had no experience with God of any kind, of any religion. But I was walking down the street, and there was a church, and they had their door open, and they were singing a song. And the song was something like, "I will never forget you, my people. I hold you in the palm of my hand. I will never forget you. I will always take care of you. I will always protect you. And I stopped and I started crying because I thought that's all I ever wanted was for someone to protect me, to keep me safe, to tell me that everything would be okay. And I thought that alcohol could do that for me, could take me away, and it didn't. And almost immediately right after that, I had a message that came to me, and I believe that it was God. I believe in my language, I say Gije Manidu. It means kind, loving, compassionate creator. That God was talking to me and saying, every single painful thing in your life is getting at you through alcohol. If you get it out of your life, you're going to be okay. And it was like one of those massive light bulb moments. Because when I sat, I stopped in my tracks and I thought about it and I thought, it's true. I had never connected every single painful thing in my life really had. Because in every instance, the people who were hurting me and myself, we were under the influence of alcohol. And I decided to reach out for help. I had like this little tiny little light that came on inside of me that said, I think I want to live if this is true. I knew someone that had, I hung out with all the people that did the most drinking and the most drugs. So I knew some people that had already gone to treatment, and I reached out and called, and they came and did a 12-step call on me. They tried to get me into treatment, but there was no insurance for that. And this was a long time ago too. So this young lady and gentleman that were there on this call, they said, you know, you're just probably going to have to do it the old school way. You're going to have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor and do what she tells you to do. And I thought, I want to live. I'll do it. I'll do anything. Which was really strange because I had never had that feeling before, but I did. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I got a sponsor. I did what she told me to do. I ended up changing all the people that were around me because I was very blessed that where I lived, there was an Alano club that had meetings all day, every day. So I could do that. And there were other people that were young like me that had gotten to a place where it was, if you don't get help, you're going to die. So I wasn't the only one. And initially, when I first walked in to AA, I should say that I tried Al-Anon first to go deal with my alcoholic parents. I had gone there first, so I knew where the Alano club was. And when I went for my first AA meeting, it was all old white guys sitting in there. And part of me just thought, oh man, one of these guys know, you know, about what my life is about, you know. But I had a really good sponsor who told me, every time you try a new meeting, go to 3 meetings before you, you know, give it up if it's not a fit. And so I sat it out for those first 3 meetings and I fell in love with those old guys. There was an old gentleman named Hart, and he really took a lot of us young people under his wing. And my first sponsor, Mary, was wonderful. Everyone was like a family. I had a new family. Everywhere I've moved and lived ever since, if there wasn't AA, I started it. Like Dr. Bob and Bill W., I just always felt like you can't complain about something if you're not willing to be a part of the solution. And in our Native communities, we did not have much for AA or later NA or Al-Anon or any of those kinds of things. And so I don't know why. I just thought I wasn't one of those people that was just going to sit around and say, well, I can't go to a meeting because there isn't one. I remembered what up in Alkali Lake, how they had talked about when they first started AA on that reserve in Canada, that it was just the first woman and the priest that were there for a whole year, the only ones that came. And yet, and then not, you know, and over time, almost their entire community was in recovery. So I never forgot that. And I will also say that besides AA, I got trauma therapy. That was really important for me to do, specific trauma therapy. And I started going to ceremonies, and it was a really good fit for me with the ceremonies, doing things like my fourth and fifth step, my sixth and seventh step, my third step. Almost all the steps, there were some kind of ceremony and cultural piece that helped me do it, helped me have even more meaning to me. And when it came through my culture, there was just a fitness to it, a rightness to it. And I didn't question that. I have in my life lived on five different reservations around Minnesota and Wisconsin. I've traveled a lot. I've traveled all over Turtle Island, the United States and Canada. I worked for Don for quite a while. And I also traveled in Europe telling my story, basically, and helping children with fetal alcohol syndrome. That was something else that I did for quite a long time. I opened my home to children that didn't have safe places to be, like I wished I would have had a safe, sober place to grow up. And I ended up eventually trying to help the mothers before they had children was my hope, that if I could help create treatment centers where women could come and Native American women and get their culture and recovery and therapy and be able to bring their children with them if they needed to. And that's been what I've been doing in my most recent, say last 5 to 10 years. And that's what I do today. I work in a treatment center for Native American women in St. Paul. I moved to help my mom. I live with my mom now. My mom's been sober. My mom sobered up 6 months before I did. And so we've grown up together, and she was a great role model. I don't know how many of you know of Hazelden, but my mom ended up being a counselor in Hazelden. And I'm really proud of her. She's amazing. But I wanna share something about my family that I'm feeling a lot of gratitude right now. So that's where the emotion's coming from. When I was brand new sober, someone had invited me to a powwow. And I wanted to go so badly, because when I was a little girl, I had one friend who her family was sober, and they danced at powwows, and they would bring me when I was really little. And it was my favorite memories of my childhood. And so right after I sobered up, someone invited me to the powwow at my home reservation. It's called Honor the Earth Homecoming Powwow every year in July. And so I went and I watched all the people there, and they were there with their families. In our culture, our riches are measured by how many relatives you have, not how much money you have. So if you have a big family, you're considered really wealthy. And I was there and thinking about all of my family was sitting in a bar somewhere drunk. And I was there all by myself. And I had this vision of someday I want that. I want what I see, these other families that have their culture and they're sober. And in all the years that I've been alive, I've never quit going to meetings. I go to two meetings a week still to this day. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. I've never stopped working on steps. And what that brought me is, I think this was about 5 years ago. I have 10 children. I have 36 grandchildren. And my first great grandchild was born a week ago. I am so excited. But every year I would go back to the homecoming powwow and bring my children. I met my husband in AA and we started having kids. And then we had about 5 biological kids and then we adopted 5 and we did foster care beyond that as well. And we brought all the kids with us. And as they grew up, they had an entirely different childhood. When they were little, I used to bring my kids with me when I was in AA and when they were little. And sometimes they'd sit in little circles and they'd say, and I'd walk in the room and they'd be saying, "My name's Cheyenne, I'm an alcoholic." And they'd all go around playing AA. And I was laughing at the time, but a lot of my kids are in recovery now. Quite a few are. But what happened with the powwows was that every year as they grew and they started having families of their own, all of us that were sober, we dance at powwows, we sing, we go to sweat, we go to ceremony. And we camp together. We have a big encampment at that powwow in particular. It would be like everybody coming home for Christmas. For us, it's July 15th, the third weekend in July every year. And we were sitting around the fire after dancing one night and looking at how many tents we had in our little encampment there. There was probably about 40 people that were my kids, my, you know, son and daughter-in-laws, my grandkids. And the kids turned and looked at me and they said, "Mom, if you hadn't sobered up, none of us would be here." And that really, really was such a gift. That's what AA did for me and my family. We have a quality of life I'd never imagined when I was drinking. And so I love that AA is all over the world. I love that there's this international gathering here. I heard the gentleman speaking that was sharing about translating the big book into Navajo, and I think that's such a beautiful thing. I don't believe we have translated the big book into Ojibwe, but we have translated the Serenity Prayer. There, I want to close with two things that I want to share about my culture, and one is to share the Serenity Prayer in Ojibwe, and then we have a song that I would like to share. That's a 400-year-old sobriety song. So it's a very powerful, and I feel very blessed that that we've been, it's been shared with us in our home group, Red Road AA and Wellbriety meetings in the Minneapolis area. So I'll go ahead and read the Serenity Prayer in Ojibwe. I don't know if there's anybody on here who's Ojibwe, but I think one of my daughters is here. But I'll give it my best shot. I'm not a fluent speaker, but I'm trying to learn my language to the best of my ability, to pray in my language at least, and to know a little bit anyways. So Kije Manidu, Dagawidu Kawishin Weweni, Chi Nana Gadawadam Adaman. Ji oda pinaman inyo, gigash kitiso tisoyan, ji anjaj soyan, ji di a pichideyan, ji anjaj soyan, gi gash kitoyan, ji di a pichi nibokayan, ji gikendaman ono. The Serenity Prayer in our language. So, and the song that I'm going to sing, it's a long song, so I'm only going to just sing like what would be considered one verse of it. But I need to, the protocol of singing a song, especially a song that's considered something that's like a ceremonial song, is you need to say the teaching of the song and who carried it before you. And so this song originally happened 300 to 400 years ago, and it involved an Ojibwe man in Rainy River community. And he was a gentleman who had high respect in his community. That's something that was really important for our people, was to be well respected in your community. And our teachings tell us, like our original instructions from Creator tell us, that you always give before you take. You don't, that generosity is really highly, highly respected in that. So there was a gentleman who was gifted hunter and fisherman and trapper. And he made sure that the people in his community that needed the most he always gave to first. And so following that cultural teaching and in high regard, and he had a beautiful wife and he had beautiful children, and he needed to go trade his furs, and a fort had just been built, and the fur traders were there, and they asked that the native people bring their furs to the fort. And so he brought them there, and he had never tasted alcohol before, but the fur traders gave alcohol to the native people before the trading would start, as a way to try to kind of swindle them and not have to pay so much for each fur. What happened to this gentleman, he said, was that when he drank that alcohol, it made a burning feeling in his belly, but he liked it. He liked that feeling. And from that moment on, he did everything to try to get that feeling back. And so instead of giving the meat that he hunted or the fish that he got in his net to the people who needed it in his community, he was selling it for alcohol. And pretty soon he lost his ability to hunt and to trap and to net fish. And his wife left him, his children left him. He had no respect from the community. He was just an alcoholic. And he despaired, and it was winter, and he decided that he would kill himself by throwing himself into the snow. And so he threw himself into the snow, and Gwingwaage came to him. That's a wolverine, and that was his spirit helper. Wolverine is the fiercest animal on Turtle Island. And he said to the man, "Look at you, you're nothing but a drunk." And did you think it was you that was, you know, getting all those fish or getting all those animals? I was helping you because you were being a good man. And he said, "I'm going to take pity on you and give you one last gift. I'm going to give you a song that will help you if you sing it, because that spirit of alcohol has taken over you. If you sing this song, it's going to help you go back to the man that Creator meant you to be." And so he taught him the song, and he decided he wanted to live, and he sang the song, and it brought him back to the culture that he had given up, and he started living the way that he was supposed to, and everything started coming back, his ability to hunt and fish, and his wife and his children came back. And I always think of the promises coming true when I think about this song. And the respect of the community came back, and he ended up becoming a medicine man. And he passed the song down from medicine man to medicine man to medicine man to medicine man to Alex Skeed to Tobasunakwed to Pebami Benes, who taught the song to me. And so I'm going to sing the song to you now, one verse of it. And the words to the song are saying, I became nothing but a drunk or an alcoholic, but I went I went back to being my true self, the person that Creator needed me to or wanted me to be. So, thank you. I was very honored to be asked to be here today.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you so much. You guys, give Cheryl a hand.
Oh,
amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Heart and spirit and soul. Cheryl, thank you.
What an inspiration you are.
The real medicine. Thank you. Outstanding.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Cheryl. You were obviously supposed to be here. I mean, that's just uncanny to me. I'm grateful. Thank you so much.